Is hunting and thought he would surprise me by coming home early. My God! It is you! Edward! It is you! Is it really you? It is me, he confirms. I greet you too, my Lady Mother Jacquetta. I fling myself at him, and as his arms come around me, I smell his familiar scent and feel the strength of his chest, and I sob at the very touch of him. I thought you were in prison, I say. I thought he was going to kill you. Lost his nerve, he says shortly, trying to stroke my back and take down my hair at the same time. Sir Humphrey Neville raised Yorkshire for Henry, and when Warwick went against him, nobody supported him. He needed me. He started to see that nobody would have George for king, and I would not sign away my throne. He hadn't bargained for that. He didn't dare behead me. To say truth, I don't think he could find a headsman to do it. I am crowned king. He can't just lop off my head as if it were firewood. I am ordained. My body is sacred. Not even Warwick dares to kill a king in cold blood. He came to me with the paper of my abdication, and I told him that I couldn't see my way to signing. I was happy to stay in his house. The cook is excellent, and the cellar better. I told him I was happy to move my whole court to Middleham Castle if he wanted me as a guest forever. I said I could see no reason why my rule should not run from his castle at his expense, but that I would never deny who I am. He laughs, his loud, confident laugh. Sweetheart, you should have seen him. He thought if he had me in his power that he had the crown at his bidding, but he found me unhelpful. It was as good as a mumming to see him puzzle as to what to do. Once I heard you were safely in the tower, I wasn't afraid of anything. He thought I would break when he took hold of me, and I didn't even bend. He thought I was still the little boy who adored him. He didn't realize that I'm a grown man. I was a most agreeable guest. I ate well, and when friends came to see me, I demanded that they be entertained royally. First, I asked to walk in the gardens, then in the forest. Then I said I should like to ride out, and what would be the harm in letting me go hunting? He started to let me ride out. My council came and demanded to see me, and he did not know how to refuse them. I met them, and passed the odd law or two so that everyone knew nothing had changed. I was still reigning as king. It was hard not to laugh in his face. He thought to imprison me, and found instead he was merely bearing the cost of a full court. Sweetheart, I asked for a choir while I dined, and he could not see how to refuse me. I hired dancers and players. He started to see that merely holding the king is not enough. You have to destroy him. You have to kill him. But I gave him nothing. He knew I would die before I gave him anything. Then one fine morning, 4 days ago, his grooms made the mistake of giving me my own horse, my war horse, Fury, and I knew he could outrun anything in their stables. So I thought I would ride a little farther and a little faster than usual, that's all. I thought I might be able to ride to you, and I have done. It is over? I ask incredulously. You got away. He grins in his pride like a boy. I would like to see the horse that could catch me on Fury, he said. They had left him in the stable for 2 weeks, feeding him oats. I was at Ripon before I could draw breath. I couldn't have pulled him up if I'd wanted to. I laugh, sharing his delight. Dear God, Edward, I had been so afraid. I thought I would never see you again. Beloved, I thought I would never ever see you again. He kisses my head and strokes my back. Did I not say when we first married that I will always come back to you? Did I not say I would die in my bed with you as my wife? Have you not promised to give me a son? Do you think any prison could keep me from you, ever? I press my face to his chest as if I would bury myself into his body. My love, my love. So will you go back with your guards and arrest him? No, he's too powerful. He still commands most of the north. I hope we can make peace again. He knows this rebellion has failed. He knows it is over. He is cunning enough to know that he is lost. He and George and I will have to patch together some reconciliation. They will beg my pardon, and I will forgive them. But he has learned that he cannot keep me and hold me. I am king now. He can't reverse that. He has sworn to obey me, as I have sworn to rule. I am his king. It is done, and the country has no appetite for another war between more rival kings. I don't want a war. I have sworn to bring the country justice and peace. He pulls the final pins from my hair and rubs his face against my neck. I missed you, he said, and the girls. I had a bad moment or two when they first took me into the castle, and I was in a cell with no windows. And I am sorry about your father and brother. He raises his head and looks at my mother. I am more sorry for your loss than I can say, Jacquetta, he says frankly. These are the fortunes of war, and we all know the risks. But they took two good men when they took your husband and son. My mother nods. And what will be your terms for reconciliation with the man who killed my husband and my son? I take it you will forgive him that also? Edward makes a grimace at the hardness in her voice. You will not like it, he warns us both. I shall make Warwick's nephew, Duke of Bedford. He is Warwick's heir. I have to give Warwick a stake in our family, the royal family. I have to tie him into us. You give him my old title? My mother asks incredulously. The Bedford title, my first husband's name, to a traitor. I don't care if his nephew has a dukedom, I say hastily. It is Warwick who killed my father, not the boy. I don't care about his nephew. Edward nods. There is more, he says uncomfortably. I shall give our daughter Elizabeth in marriage to young Bedford. She will make the alliance firm. I turn on him. Elizabeth? My Elizabeth? Our Elizabeth, he corrects me. Yes. You will promise her in marriage, a child of not yet 4 years old, to the family of the man who murdered her grandfather? I will. This has been a cousin's war. It has to be a cousin's reconciliation. And you, beloved, will not stop me. I have to bring Warwick to peace with me. I have to give him a great share of the wealth of England. This way I even give him a chance at his line inheriting the throne. He is a traitor and a murderer. And you think you will marry my little daughter to his nephew? I do, he says firmly. I swear that it will never happen, I say fiercely. And more, I tell you this, I foresee it will never happen. He smiles. I bow to your superior foreknowledge, he says, and sweeps a magnificent bow at my mother and me. And only time will prove your foreseeing true or false. But in the meantime, while I am King of England, with the power to give my daughter in marriage to whom I wish, I shall always do my very best to stop your enemies ducking you two as a pair of witches or strangling you at the crossroads. And I tell you, as I am king, the only way to make you and every woman and her son in this kingdom as safe as she should be is to find a way to stop this warfare. Autumn, 1469. Warwick returns to court as a beloved friend and loyal mentor. We are to be as a family that suffers occasional quarrels, but loves one another withal. Edward does this rather well. I greet Warwick with a smile as warm as a frozen fountain dripping with ice. I am expected to behave as if this man is not the murderer of my father and brother and the jailer of my husband. I do as I am commanded. Not a word of my anger escapes me, But Warwick knows without any telling that he has made a dangerous enemy for the rest of his life. He knows I can say nothing, and his small bow when he first greets me is triumphant. Your Grace, he says suavely. As ever with him, I feel at a disadvantage, like a girl. He is a great man of the world, and he was planning the fortunes of this kingdom when I was minding my manners to my Lady Grey, my husband's mother, and obeying my first husband. He looks at me as if I should still be feeding the hens at Grafton. I want to be icy, but I fear I appear only sulky. Welcome back to court, I say unwillingly. You are always gracious, he replies with a smile. Born to be queen. My son, Thomas Grey, makes a small exclamation of anger, raging like the boy he is, and takes himself out of the room. Warwick beams at me. Ah, the young, he says. A promising boy. I am only glad he was not with his grandfather and beloved uncle at Edgecote Moor, I say, hating him. Oh, so am I. He may make me feel like a fool and like a woman who can do nothing, but what I can do, I will. In my jewelry box is a dark locket of black, tarnished silver, and inside it, locked in the darkness, I have his name, Richard Neville, and that of George, Duke of Clarence, written in my blood on the piece of paper from the corner of my father's last letter. These are my enemies. I have cursed them. I will see them dead at my feet. Winter, 1469-70. At the very darkest hour of the longest night, in the heart of the winter solstice, my mother and I go down to the River Thames, black as glass. The path from the Palace of Westminster Garden runs alongside the water, and the river is high tonight, but very dark in the darkness. We can hardly see it, but we can hear it, washing against the jetty and slapping against the walls, and we can feel it, a black, wide presence, breathing like a great, sinuous animal, heaving gently, like the sea. This is our element. I inhale the smell of the cold water like someone scenting her own land after a long exile. I have to have a son, I say to my mother. And she smiles and says, I know. In her pocket, she has three charms on three threads, and careful as a fisherman baiting a line, she throws each of them into the river and gives me the thread to hold. I hear a little splash as each one falls into the water, and I am reminded of the golden ring that I drew from the river 5 years ago at home. You choose, she says to me. You choose which one you draw out. She spreads out the three threads in my left hand, and I hold them tightly. The moon comes out from behind the cloud. It is a waning moon, fat and silvery. It draws a line of light along the dark water, and I choose one thread and hold it in my right hand. This one. Are you sure? Yes. At once she takes a pair of silver scissors from her pocket and cuts the other two threads so whatever was tied on is swept away into the dark waters. What were they? They are the things that will never happen. They are the future that we will never know. They are the children who will not be born, and the chances that we won't take, and the luck that we won't have, she says. They are gone. They are lost to you. See instead what you have chosen. I lean over the palace wall to draw on the thread, and it comes from the water, dripping. At the end is a silver spoon, a beautiful little silver spoon for a baby, and when I catch it in my hand I see, shining in the moonlight, that it is engraved with a coronet and the name Edward. We keep Christmas in London as a feast of reconciliation, as if a feast will make a friend of Warwick. I am reminded of all the times that poor King Henry tried to bring his enemies together and make them swear friendship. And I know that others at the court see Warwick and George as honored guests and laugh behind their hands. Edward orders that it should be done grandly, and nearly 2,000 noblemen of England sit down to dinner with us on Twelfth Night, Warwick chief among them all. Edward and I wear our crowns and the newest fashions and the richest cloths. I wear only silver white and cloth of gold in this winter season, and they say that I am the White Rose of York indeed. Edward and I give gifts to 1,000 of the diners and favors to them all. Warwick is a most popular guest, and he and I greet each other with absolute courtesy. When commanded by my husband, I even dance with my brother-in-law George, hand to hand and smiling into his handsome, boyish face. Again it strikes me how like my husband Edward he is, a smaller, daintier version of Edward's blonde handsomeness. Again I am struck by how people like him on sight. He has all of the York easy charm and none of Edward's honor. But I don't forget. And I don't forgive. I greet his new bride, Isabel, Warwick's daughter, with kindness. I welcome her to my court and wish her very well. She is a poor, thin, pale girl, looking rather aghast at the part she has to play in her father's scheme of things. Now she is married into the most treacherous and dangerous family in England, at the court of the king that her husband betrayed. She is in need of a little kindness, and I am sisterly and loving to her. A stranger at court, visiting us in this most hospitable season, would think that I love her as a kinswoman. He would think I had not lost a father, a brother. He would think that I have no memory at all. I don't forget. And in my jewelry case is a dark locket. And in the dark locket there is the corner of the page of my father's last letter, and on that scrap of paper, written in my own blood, are the names Richard Neville, Earl of Warwick, and George, Duke of Clarence. I don't forget, and one day they will know that. Warwick remains enigmatic, the greatest man in the kingdom after the king. He accepts the honors and favors that are shown him with icy dignity, as a man to whom everything is due. His accomplice, George, is like a hound puppy, jumping and fawning. Isabel, George's wife, sits with my ladies, between my sisters and my sister-in-law Elizabeth, and I cannot help but smile when I see her turn her head away from her husband's dancing, or the way she flinches as he shouts out toasts in honor of the king. George, so fair-headed and round-faced, has always been a beloved boy of the Yorks, and at this Christmas feast he acts towards his older brother not only as if he has been forgiven, but also as if he will always be forgiven anything. He is the spoiled child of the family. He really believes he can do no wrong. The youngest York brother, Richard, Duke of Gloucester, now 17 and a handsome, slight boy, may be the baby of the family, but he has never been the favorite. Of all the York boys, he is the only one to resemble his father, and he is dark and small-boned, a little changeling beside the big-boned, handsome York line. He is a pious young man, thoughtful, most at home in his great house in the north of England, where he lives a life of duty and austere service to his people. He finds our glittering court an embarrassment, as if we were aggrandizing ourselves as pagans at a Christian feast. He looks on me, I swear it, as if I were a dragon sprawled greedily over treasure, not a mermaid in silver water. I guess that he looks at me with both desire and fear. He is a child, afraid of a woman whom he could never understand. Beside him, my grey sons, only a little younger, are worldly and cheerful. They keep inviting him out to hunt with them, to go drinking in the alehouses, to roist around the streets in masks, and he, nervously, declines. News of our Christmas feast goes all around Christendom. The new court in England is said to be the most beautiful, elegant, mannered, and gracious court in Europe. Edward is determined that the English court of York shall become as famous as Burgundy for fashion and beauty and culture. He loves good music, and we have a choir singing or musicians playing at every meal. My ladies and I learn the court dances and compose our own. My brother Anthony is a great guide and advisor in all of this. He has travelled in Italy and speaks of the new learning and the new arts, of the beauty of the ancient cities of Greece and of Rome and how their arts and their studies can be made new. He speaks to Edward of bringing in painters and poets and musicians from Italy, of using the wealth of the crown to found schools and universities. He speaks of the new learning, of new science, of arithmetic and astronomy, and everything new and wonderful. He speaks of arithmetic that starts with the number zero and tries to explain how this transforms everything. He speaks of a science that can calculate distances that cannot be measured. He says it should be possible to know the distance to the moon. Elizabeth, his wife, watches him quietly and says that he is a magus, a wise man. We are a court of beauty, grace, and learning, and Edward and I command the best of everything. I am amazed at the cost of running a court, of the price of all this beauty, even the charges for food, of the continual demands from every courtier for a hearing, for a place, for a slice of land or a favour, for a post where he can levy taxes, or for help in claiming an inheritance. "This is what it is to be a king," Edward says to me, as he signs the last of the day's petitions. "As King of England, I own everything. Every duke and earl and baron holds his lands at my favour. Every knight and squire below him has a stream from the river. Every petty farmer and tenant and copyholder and peasant below him depends on my favour. I have to give out wealth and power in order to keep the rivers flowing. And if it goes wrong, at the least sign of it going wrong, there will be someone saying that they wished Henry was back on the throne, that it was better in the old days, or that they think his son, Edward, or George, might do a more generous job. Oh, surely to God there is another claimant to the throne somewhere. Margaret Beaufort's son, Henry. Let's have the Lancaster boy for a change, who might speed the flow. To keep my power, I have to give it away in carefully spaced and chosen pitches. I have to please everyone, but none too much. They are money-grubbing peasants, I say irritably. And their loyalty goes with their interest. They think of nothing but their own desires. They are worse than serfs. He smiles at me. They are indeed, every one of them. And each of them wants their little estate and their little house, just as I want my throne, and as much as you wanted the manor of Sheen and places for all your kinsmen. We are all anxious for wealth and land, and I own it all and have to give it out carefully. Spring, 1470. As the weather turns warmer, and it starts to grow brighter in the mornings, and the birds start to sing in the gardens of Westminster Palace, Edward's informers bring him reports from Lincolnshire of another uprising in favour of Henry the King, as though he were not forgotten by everyone else in the world, living quietly in the Tower of London, more an anchorite than a prisoner. I shall have to go, Edward says to me, letter in his hand. If this leader, whoever he is a forerunner for Margaret of Anjou, then I have to defeat him before she lands her army in his support. It looks like she plans to use him to test the support of her cause, to have him take the risk of raising troops and when she sees he has raised an English army for her, she will land her French one, and then I will have to face them both. Will you be safe, I ask, against this person who has not even the courage to have a name of his own? As always, he says steadily. But I won't let the army go out without me again. I have to be there. I have to lead. And where is your loyal friend, Warwick? I ask acidly. And your trusted brother, George? Are they recruiting for you? Are they hurrying to be at your side? He smiles at my tone. Ah, you are mistaken, little queen of mistrust. I have a letter here from Warwick offering to raise men to march with me, and George says he will come too. Then you make sure that you watch them in battle, I say, completely unconvinced. They will not be the first men to bring soldiers to the battlefield and change sides at the last moment. When the enemy is before you, cast an eye behind you to see what your true and loyal friends are doing at the rear. They have promised their loyalty, he soothes me. Truly, my dearest, trust me. I can win battles. I know you can, I know you do, I say. But it is so hard to see you march out. When will it end? When will they stop raising an army for a cause which is over? Soon, he says. They will see we are united, and we are strong. Warwick will bring in the North to our side, and George will prove to be a true brother. Richard is with me, as always. I will come home as soon as this man is defeated. I will come home early, and I will dance with you on May Day morning, and you will smile. Edward, you know, just this once, this one time, I think I cannot bear to see you go. Cannot Richard command the army, with Hastings? Can you not stay with me? This time, just this time. He takes my hands and presses them against his lips. He is not affected by my anxiety, but amused by it. He is smiling. Oh, why this time? Why does this time matter so much? Do you have something to tell me? I cannot resist him. I am smiling in return. I do have something to tell you, but I have been saving it. I know. Did you think I didn't know? So, tell me, what is this secret that I am supposed not to have any idea about? It should bring you home safely to me, I say. It should bring you home quickly to me, and not send you out in your pomp. He waits, smiling. He has been waiting for me to tell him, as I have been reveling in the secret. Tell me, he says. This has been a long time coming. I am with child again, I say, and this time I know it is a boy. He scoops me to him and holds me gently. I knew it, he says. I knew that you were with child. I knew it in my bones. And how can you know it is a boy, my little witch, my enchantress? I smile up at him, secure in women's mysteries. Ah, you don't need to know how I know, I say. But you can know that I am certain. You can be sure of it. Know this, we will have a boy. My son, Prince Edward, he says. I laugh, thinking of the silver spoon that I drew out of the silvery river on Midwinter's Eve. How do you know that his name will be Edward? Of course it will. I have been determined on it for years. Your son, Prince Edward, I repeat. So make sure you are home safely, in time for his birth. Do you know when? In the autumn. I will come home safely to bring you peaches and salt cod. What was it you wanted so much when you were big with Cecily? Samphire. I laugh. Fancy you remembering. I could not have enough of it. Make sure you come home to bring me samphire and anything else I crave. This is a boy. This is a prince. He must have whatever he desires. He will be born with a silver spoon. I shall come home to you, and you are not to worry. I don't want him born with a frown. Then you beware of Warwick and your brother. I don't trust them. Promise to rest, and be happy, and make him strong in your belly. Promise to come back safe and make him strong in his inheritance, I counter. It is a promise. He was wrong. Dear God, Edward was so wrong. Not, thank God, about winning the battle, for that was the battle that they called Losecoat Field, when the barefooted fools, fighting for a lackwit king, were in such a rush to run away that they dropped their weapons and even their coats to escape from the charge led by my husband, who was fighting his way through them, to keep his promise to me, to come home in time to bring me peaches and samphire. No, he was wrong about the loyalty of Warwick and George, his brother, who, it turned out, had planned and paid for the uprising, and had decided this time to be certain of Edward's defeat. They were going to kill my Edward and put George on the throne. His own brother, and Warwick, who had been his best friend, had decided together that the only way to defeat Edward was to stab him from behind on the battlefield. And they would have done it, too, but for the fact that he rode so fast in the charge that no man could catch him. Before the battle had even begun, Lord Richard Wells, the petty leader, had gone down on his knees to Edward, confessed the plan, and showed Warwick's orders and George's money. They paid him to lead an uprising in the name of King Henry, but in truth it was only a feint to draw Edward into battle and to kill him there. Warwick had learned his lesson, truly. He had learned that you cannot hold a man like my Edward. He has to be dead to be defeated. George, his own brother, had overcome his fraternal affection. He was ready to slit his brother's throat on the battlefield and to wade through his blood to get to the crown. The two of them had bribed and ordered poor Lord Wells to raise a battle to bring Edward into danger, and then found once again that Edward was too much for them. When Edward saw the evidence against them, he summoned them as kinsmen, the friend who had been an older brother to him, and the youth who was his brother indeed. And when they did not come, he knew what to think of them at last, and he summoned them as traitors to answer to him. But they were long gone. I shall see them dead, I say to my mother, as we sit before an open window in my privy chamber at Westminster Palace, spinning wool and gold thread to make yarn for a costly cloak for the baby. It will be purest lamb's wool and priceless gold, a cloak fit for a little prince, the greatest prince in Christendom. I shall see the two of them dead. I swear it, whatever you say. She nods at the spindle in her hand and the wool I am carding. Don't put ill-wishing into his little cape, she says. I stop the wheel and put the wool to one side. There, I say, the work can wait, but the ill-wishing cannot. Did you know? Edward promised a safe conduct to Lord Richard Wells if he would confess his treason and reveal the plot. But when he did so, he broke his word and killed him. I shake my head. My mother's face is grave. Now the Beaufort family are in mourning for their kinsman, Wells, and Edward has given a new cause to his enemies. He has broken his word, too. No one will trust him again. No one will dare to surrender to him. He has shown himself a man who cannot be trusted, as bad as Warwick. I shrug. These are the fortunes of war. Margaret Beaufort knows them as well as I. And she would have been unhappy anyway, since she is the heir to the House of Lancaster, and we summoned her husband Henry Stafford to march out for us. I give a hard laugh. Poor man, caught between her and our summons. My mother can't hide her smile. No doubt she was on her knees all the while, she says cattily. For a woman who boasts that she has the ear of God, she has little benefit to show for it. Anyway, Wells doesn't matter, I say, alive or dead. What matters is that Warwick and George will be heading for the court of France, speaking ill of us and hoping to raise an army. We have a new enemy, and this one is in our own house, our own heir. What a family the Yorks are. Where are they now? My mother asks me. At sea, heading for Calais, according to Anthony. Isabel is big with child on board ship with them, and no one to care for her but her mother, the Countess of Warwick. They will be hoping to enter Calais and raise an army. Warwick is beloved there, and if they put themselves in Calais, we will have no safety at all with them waiting just over the sea, threatening our ships, half a day's sail away from London. They must not enter Calais. We have to prevent it. Edward has sent the fleet to sea, but our ships will never catch them in time. I rise to my feet and lean out of the open window into the sunshine. It is a warm day. The River Thames below me sparkles like a fountain. It is calm. I look to the southwest. There is a line of dark clouds on the horizon, as if there might be dirty weather at sea. I put my lips together, and I blow a little whistle. Behind me, I hear my mother's spindle laid aside, and then I hear the soft sound of her whistle also. I keep my eye on the line of clouds, and I let my breath hiss like the wind of a storm. She comes to stand behind me, her arm around my broad waist. Together we whistle gently into the spring air, blowing up a storm. Slowly, but powerfully, the dark clouds pile up, one on top of another, until there is a great thunderhead of threatening dark cloud, south, far away, over the sea. The air freshens. I shiver in the sudden chill, and we turn from the cooler, darkening day and close the window on the first scud of rain. Looks like a storm out at sea, I remark. A week later, my mother comes to me with a letter in her hand. I have news from my cousin in Burgundy. She writes that George and Warwick were blown off the coast of France and then nearly wrecked in terrible seas off Calais. They begged the fort to let them enter for the sake of Isabel, but the castle would not admit them, and they had the chain up across the entrance to the port. A wind got up from nowhere, and the seas nearly drove them onto the walls. The fort would not let them in. They could not land the boat in high seas. Poor Isabel went into labor in the middle of the storm. They were tossed about for hours, and her baby died. I cross myself. God bless the poor little one, I say. Nobody would have wished that on them. Nobody did, my mother says robustly. But if Isabel had not taken ship with traitors, then she would have been safe in England with midwives and friends to care for her. Poor girl, I say, a hand on my own big belly. Poor girl. She has had little joy from her grand marriage. Do you remember her at court at Christmas? There is worse news, my mother goes on. Warwick and George have gone to his great friend, King Louis of France, and now the two of them have met with Margaret d'Anjou at Angers, and another plot is spinning, just as we have been spinning here. Warwick still goes on against us. My mother makes a grimace. He must be a determined man indeed, to see his own grandchild still born while his family is on the run, and go from a near shipwreck straight to forswear his oaths of loyalty. But nothing stops him. You would think a storm out of a blue sky would make him wonder, but nothing makes him wonder. Now he is courting Margaret d'Anjou, whom he once fought against. He had to spend half an hour on his knees to beg the forgiveness of her, his greatest enemy. She would not see him without his act of contrition. God bless her. She always did take herself very high. What do you think he plans? It is the French king who is planning the dance now. Warwick thinks he is kingmaker, but now he is a puppet. They call Louis of France the spider, and I must say he spins a finer thread even than us. He wants to bring down your husband and diminish our country. He is using Warwick and Margaret d'Anjou to do it. Margaret's son, the so-called Prince of Wales, Prince Edward of Lancaster, is to marry Warwick's younger daughter Anne, to bind their lying parents together in a pact they cannot dishonor. Then I imagine they will all come to England to free Henry from the Tower. That little thing, Anne Neville, I demand, immediately diverted. They would give her to that monster Edward to make sure her father does not play false. They will, my mother agrees. She is only 14, and they are marrying her to a boy who was allowed to choose how to execute his enemies when he was 11 years old. He was raised to be a devil. Anne Neville must be wondering if she is rising to be queen or falling among the damned. But it changes everything for George, I say, thinking aloud. It was one thing to fight his brother, the king, when he hoped to kill him and succeed him. But now? Why would he fight Edward when he gains nothing for himself? Why would he fight his brother to put the Lancaster king and then the Lancaster prince on the throne? I suppose he didn't think such a thing would happen when he set sail with a wife near her time and a father-in-law determined to win the crown. But now he has lost his son and heir, and his father-in-law has a second daughter who could be queen. George's prospects are changed very much. He should have the sense to see that. But you think he has? Someone should advise him. Our eyes meet. I never have to spell things out for my mother. We understand each other so well. Shall you visit the king's mother before dinner? Mother asks me. I take my foot from the pedal of the spinning wheel and stop it with my hand. Let's go and see her now, I suggest. She is sitting with her women, sewing an altar cloth. One of them is reading from the Bible as they work. She is famously devout. Her suspicion that we are not as saintly as she, worse, perhaps pagans, worst of all, perhaps witches, is just one of the many fears she holds against me. The years have not improved her view of me. She did not want me to marry her son. And even now, though I have proved my fertility and myself a good wife for him, she hates me still. Indeed, she has been so discourteous that Edward has given her Fotheringay to keep her from court. As for me, I am not impressed by her sanctity. If she is such a good woman, then she should have taught George better. If she had the ear of God, she would not have lost her son Edmund and her husband. I curtsy to her as we enter, and she rises to curtsy low to me. She nods her women to pick up their work and go to one side. She knows I am not visiting her to inquire after her health. There is still no great love lost between us, and never will be. Your Grace, she says levelly, I am honored. My Lady Mother, I say, smiling, the pleasure is mine. We all sit simultaneously in order to avoid the issue of priority, and she waits for me to speak. I am so concerned for you, I say sweetly. I am sure you are worried about George, so far from home, proclaimed as a traitor, and all but entrapped with the traitor Warwick, estranged from his brother and from his family. His first baby lost his own life in such danger. She blinks. She had not anticipated my concern for her favorite, George. Of course I wish he were reconciled to us, she says cautiously. It is always sad when brothers quarrel. And now I hear that George is abandoning his own family, I say plaintively. A turncoat, not just against his brother, but against you and against his own house. She looks at my mother for an explanation. He has joined Margaret d'Anjou, my mother says bluntly. Your son, a Yorkist, is going to fight for the Lancastrian king. Shameful. He will be defeated for certain. Edward always wins, I say. And then he must be executed as a traitor. How can Edward spare him, even for brotherly love, if George takes up the Lancaster colours? Think of him dying with a red rose at his collar. The shame for you. What would his father have said? She is truly aghast. He would never follow Margaret of Anjou, she says. His father's greatest enemy. Margaret of Anjou put George's father's head on a spike on the walls of York, and now he serves her, I say thoughtfully. How can any of us ever forgive him? It cannot be so, she says. He might be tempted to join Warwick. It is hard for him to always come second to Edward, and... She breaks off, but we all know that George is jealous of everyone. His brother Richard, Hastings, me, and all of my kin. We know she has filled his head with wild thoughts that Edward is a bastard, and so he is the true heir. And besides, what... What good does it do him? I supplement smoothly. I see what you think of him. Indeed, he always thinks of nothing but his gain, and never of loyalty, or his word, or his honour. He is all George and no York. She flushes at that, but she cannot deny that George has been the most selfish, spoiled boy who ever turned coat. He thought when he went with Warwick that Warwick would make him king, I say bluntly. Then they found that nobody would have George for king if they could have Edward. Only two people in the country think George is a better man than my husband. She waits. George himself and you, I say precisely. Then he fled with Warwick because he did not dare face Edward after betraying him again. And now he finds that Warwick's plan has changed. Warwick will not put George on the throne. He will marry Anne, his daughter, to Edward of Lancaster. He will put the young Edward of Lancaster on the throne and become father-in-law to the King of England that way. George and Isabel are no longer his choice for King and Queen of England. Now it is Edward of Lancaster and Anne. The best that George can hope for is to be brother-in-law to the usurping Lancaster King of England instead of brother to the rightful York King. George's mother nods. Little profit for him, I observe, for a great deal of work and dreadful danger. I let her think on this for a moment. Now, if he were to turn his coat again and come back to his brother, penitent and truly loyal, Edward would have him back, I say. Edward would forgive him. He would? I nod. I can promise it. I don't add that I will never forgive him, and that he and Warwick are dead men to me, and have been ever since they executed my father and brother after the Battle of Edgecote Moor, and they will be dead men hereafter, whatever they do. Their names are in the black locket in my jewelry case, and their names will never see the light again until they themselves are in the eternal darkness. It would be such a good thing if George, a young man without good advisers, could hear from someone, in private, in secret, that he could come back safely to his brother, my mother observes at random, looking out of the window at the scudding clouds. Sometimes a young man needs good advice. Sometimes he needs to be told that he has taken a wrong turning, but that he can come back to the high road. A young man such as George should not be fighting for Lancaster, dying with a red rose on his collar. A young man like George should be with his family, with his brothers who love him. She pauses, to let his mother think this through. It is really beautifully done. If only someone could tell him that he was welcome at home. Then you would have your son back. The brothers would be reunited. York would fight for York once more, and George would lose nothing. He would be brother to the King of England, and he would be Duke of Clarence as he has always been. We could undertake that Edward would restore him. There lies his future. This other way he is... what would one call him? She pauses to wonder what one would call Cecily's favourite son. Then she finds the words. An utter numpty. The king's mother rises to her feet. My mother gets up too. I stay seated, smiling up at her, letting her stand before me. I always so enjoy talking with you both, she says, her voice trembling with anger. Now I rise, my hand on my spreading belly, and I wait for her to curtsy to me. Oh, me too. Good day, my lady mother, I say pleasantly. And so it is done, as easily as an enchantment. Without another word said, without Edward even knowing, a lady from the king's mother's court decides to visit her great friend, George's wife, poor Isabel Neville. The lady, heavily veiled, takes a boat, goes to Angers, finds Isabel, wastes no time on her crying in her room, finds George, tells him of his mother's tender love and her concerns for him. George tells her in return of his increasing discomfort with the allies to whom he has not only sworn, but also married. God, he thinks, does not bless their union since their baby died in the storm, and nothing has gone right for him since he married Isabel. Surely nothing as unpleasant as this should ever happen to George. Now he finds himself in the company of his family's enemies, and, far worse for him, in second place again. Turncoat George says that he will come to England with the invading army of Lancaster, but as soon as he sets foot in his beloved brother's kingdom, he will tell us where they have landed and what is their strength. He will seem to stand by them as brother-in-law to the Lancaster Prince of Wales until the battle is joined, and then he will attack them from behind and fight his way through to his brothers once more. He will be a son of York, one of the three sons of York again. We can rely on him. He will destroy his present friends and his wife's own family. He is loyal to York. In his innermost heart, he has always been loyal to York. My husband brings this encouraging news to me, unaware that this is the doing of women, spinning their toils around men. I am resting on my daybed, one hand on my belly, feeling the baby move. Isn't this wonderful? He asks me, truly delighted. George will come back to us. I know that you love George, I say. But even you have to admit he is an absolute crawling thing, loyal to no one. My generous-hearted husband smiles. Oh, he is George, he says kindly. You can't be too hard on him. He has always been everyone's favorite. He has always been one to please himself. I find a smile in return. I am not too hard on him, I say. I am glad he has come back to you. And inwardly, I say to myself, but he is a dead man. Summer, 1470. I am running behind my husband, my hand on my large belly, down the long winding corridors of the Palace of Whitehall. Servants run behind us carrying goods. You can't go. You swore to me you would be with me for the birth of our baby. It will be a boy, your son. You must be with me. He turns, his face grave. Sweetheart, our son will have no kingdom if I don't go. Warwick's brother-in-law, Henry Fitzhugh, has raised Northumberland. There's no doubt in my mind that Warwick will strike in the north, and then Margaret will land her army in the south. She will come straight to London to free her husband from the Tower. I have to go, and I have to go fast. I have to deal with the one and then turn and march south to catch the other before she comes here for you. I don't dare even stop for the pleasure of arguing with you. What about me? What about me and the girls? He is muttering orders to the clerk, who runs behind him with a writing desk as he strides towards the stables. He pauses to shout orders at his equerries. Soldiers are rushing to the armory to draw their weapons and breastplates. Sergeants are bawling at them to fall in. The great wagons are being loaded again with tents, weapons, food, gear. The great army of York is on the march again. You have to go to the Tower. He swings round to order me. I have to know you are safe. All of you, your mother as well, go to the royal rooms in the Tower. Prepare for the baby there. You know I will come to you as soon as I can. When the enemy is in Northumberland, why should I go to the Tower when you are riding out to fight an enemy hundreds of miles away? Because only the devil knows for sure where Warwick and Margaret will land, he says briefly. I'm guessing they'll split into two battles and land one to support the uprising in the north and the other in Kent. But I don't know. I've not heard from George. I don't know what they plan. Suppose they sail up the Thames while I am fighting in Northumberland. Be my love. Be brave. Be a queen. Go to the Tower with the girls and keep yourselves safe. Then I can fight and win and come home to you. My boys, I whisper. Your boys will come with me. I shall keep them as safe as I can, but it is time they played their part in our battles, Elizabeth. The baby turns inside me, as if he is protesting too, and I am silenced by the heave of the movement. Edward, when will we ever be safe? When I have won, he says steadily. Let me go and win now, beloved. I let him go. I think no power in the world would have stopped him. And I tell the girls that we are staying in London at the Tower, one of their favorite palaces, and that their father and their half-brothers have gone to fight the bad men who still hanker after the old King Henry, though he is a prisoner at the Tower himself, silent in his rooms on the floor just below us. I tell them that their father will come home safe to us. When they cry for him in the night, for they have bad dreams about the wicked queen and the mad king and their bad Uncle Warwick, I promise them that their father will defeat the bad people and come home. I promise he will bring the boys safely back. He has given his word. He has never failed. He will come home. But this time, he does not. This time, he does not. He and his brothers-in-arms, my brother Anthony, his brother Richard, his beloved friend Sir William Hastings, and his loyal supporters, are shaken awake at Doncaster in the early hours of the morning by a couple of the king's minstrels, who, coming drunkenly home from whoring, happen to glance over the castle walls and see torches on the road. The enemy advance guard, marching at night, a sure sign of Warwick in command, is only an hour away, perhaps only moments away, coming to snatch the king before he can meet with his army. The whole of the north is up against the king and ready to fight for Warwick, and the royal party will be taken in a moment. Warwick's influence runs deep and wide in this part of the world, and Warwick's brother and Warwick's brother-in-law have turned out against Edward and are fighting for their kinsmen and for King Henry, and will be at the castle gate within an hour. There is no doubt in anyone's mind that this time Warwick will not take prisoners. Edward dispatches my boys to me, and then he, Richard, Anthony, and Hastings fling themselves on their horses and ride away in the night, desperate not to be taken by Warwick or his kinsmen, certain that this time there will be a summary execution for them. Warwick tried once to capture and keep Edward, as we have captured and kept Henry, and learned that there is no victory as final as death. He will never again imprison Edward and wait for everyone to concede defeat. This time, he wants him dead. Edward rides out into the darkness with his friends and kinsmen.